Let's turn to 2 Samuel chapter 8 is where we left off. David now is coming into the battles. The author has kind of put all these things together chronologically. Everything doesn't fit exactly here. But what he's doing now is showing, after David has gotten this incredible promise of the Lord about, remember the big no. You know, no, I'm not going to let you build my temple. No, I'm not going to let you do it. And yet, as David says, I want to build you a house, God says, no, I'm going to build you a house. And he gets this incredible promise. So now you see basically the fulfillment in chapter 8 and on through as God fulfills the promise to David and empowers him and gives him victory over his enemies. So after this, it came to pass that David attacked the Philistines and subdued them. And David took Metheg-Ammah from the hand of the Philistines. That would be Gath, a major, major route. And he defeated Moab, forcing them down to the ground. He measuring them off with a line. So he's defeated the Philistines. He's defeated Gath. Hold on one second. I seem to be getting a little bit of feedback from the fan there. And he's now after the Philistines, he's coming and focusing on Moab. And when you read this, it seems harsh. Notice, forcing them to the ground, measuring them off of the line, which would have been an Eastern custom. By lot, it would determine who would live and who would die. With two lines, he measured off those to be put to death, and with one full line, those to be kept alive. So the Moabites became David's servants and brought them tribute. Now, why David was very cruel with the Moabites, it's difficult to know. Tradition has it that when he sent his family down there for protection when he was running from Saul, that the Moabites eventually turned on them and killed them. Remember, actually, David's great-great-grandmother was Ruth, who was a Moabitess. So he had the connection there. But somehow or another, the natural problems of Moab, and if you remember the history of Moab, Moab came as a nation when, if you remember, Lot, in his indiscretion, basically his daughters, fearing that they wouldn't have any inheritance or any children, got Lot to sleep with them. And you find Moab came as a result of that, and also Ammon. So the children of Ammon, the children of Moab, eventually become thorns in the side of Israel later on. And Moab here is dealt with and subdued. David also defeated Hadadezer, the son of Rahab, king of Zobah, as he went to recover his territory at the river Euphrates. So you see the expansion of the territory way out. David took from him 1,000 chariots, 700 horsemen, 20,000 foot soldiers, and also David hamstrung all the chariot horses except that he spared enough of them for 100 chariots. Now, again, another seemingly cruel act, but he is basically rendering these horses useless for that which they were bred, that is to be war horses and taken into war, chariot horses. So the Lord already promised her, basically it was one of the commands that the king was not to multiply horses. The reason, God did not want him to look at his chariots and his horses to determine the strength. It's kind of like today if we were to look at America and say we're strong because we've got the greatest technology right now. We're ahead of the game in the technology of weapons of war. We've shown our prowess throughout the world so that we now trust in our own technology. As soon as you start doing that, you're in dangerous ground. Because the Bible says some trust in chariots, some in horses, but we will trust in the name of the Lord our God. And I believe that when we humble ourselves, even as a nation, as a people, and humble ourselves and recognize God as opposed to our own natural military strength, we're in safer ground. And so David at least obeys here and does not multiply horses at this time. Solomon, his son, however, does not take this policy. When the Syrians of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, the king of Zobah, David killed 22,000 of the Syrians. And David put garrisons in Syria, Damascus, and Syrians became David's servants and brought tribute. And the Lord preserved David wherever he went. And David took the shields of gold that had belonged to the servants of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem. And from Berathai, cities of Hadadezer, King David took a large amount of bronze. You notice what's happening is collecting an incredible amount of wealth that eventually will be used in the building of the temple. When Toi, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated all the army of Hadadezer's, then Toi sent Joram, his son, to King David to greet him and bless him, because he had fought against Hadadezer and defeated him, for Hadadezer had wars with Toi, and Joram brought with him articles of silver, articles of gold, and articles of bronze. And King David dedicated these to the Lord, along with the silver and gold that he had dedicated from the nations which he had subdued, from Syria, from Moab, from the people of Ammon, and from the Philistines, from Amalek, and from the spoil of Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, king of Zobah. And David made himself a name when he returned from killing 18,000 Syrians in the Valley of Salt. Now, according to the Chronicles, this is it's 18,000 Edomites, because in verse 14 it says he put garrisons in Edom. Throughout all Edom he put garrisons, and all the Edomites became David's servants, and the Lord preserved David wherever he went. Now, under Abishai, it says David made a name for himself, but Abishai led the victory against the Edomites, and it may have been some type of a confederacy with the Syrians, it's very possible, so that each of the accounts is true in their own right. David made a name for himself when he defeated the Syrian portion of that confederacy, and Abishai is credited with the Edomite portion, but he put the garrisons in Edom. So David reigned over all Israel. David administered judgment and justice to his people. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was over the army. Remember how he got that honor? Because he conquered the city of Jerusalem. And Jehoshaphat, the son of Ehalad, was the recorder. Zadok, the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, were priests, and Seraiah was the scribe. So you see his men. These men you'll find later on in his kingdom have a prominent role. Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada, was over both the Cherethites and the Pelethites, and David's son were chief ministers. So here is his administration, and he's ruling, he is king. The neat thing is, this is an interesting type of Christ, judging and reigning. When Christ comes back, there is going to be an equal picture of judgment on the nations that did not want him to rule over them. And God will judge. He is patient. He is not willing that any should perish. He is very, very patient. But one day he will come back and judge, and then when he rules, his administration will be perfect. What a day that will be to know that justice will be met. I think of just how society will be when he's reigning. When you have a righteous king, and you don't have the corruption which is noted among the politicians today, all the side deals and the kickbacks and the payoffs and all just the cheating, lying and stealing that goes on, the deception. Imagine a society that does not have that. I mean, that's what you and I long for. It's what we were made for. And yet we don't see it. This world is corrupt, because who's in control right now? Well, Satan is a usurper, but man is the administrator of these things. And it's a tragic thing when you see that type of rule. But the righteous rejoice when there is a goodly, godly man on the throne. But when the wicked reign, the people tremble. Now David said, "Is there still anyone who is left of the house of Saul that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake?" And there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and when they had called him to David, the king said to him, "Are you Ziba?" And he said, "At your service." And the king said, "Is there not still someone of the house of Saul to whom I may show kindness of God?" And Ziba said to the king, "There is still a son of Jonathan who is lame in his feet." Remember, the nurse fell on him when he was just a baby, and he became lame. And the king said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "Indeed, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, in Lo-debar." And king sent and brought him out of the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, from Lo-debar. Now when Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, had come to David, he fell on his face and prostrated himself. And David said, "Mephibosheth?" And he answered, "Here is your servant." Now just to get a picture of what's going on here. Normally, when a king was defeated or overthrown, or there was a rebellion and he was put out, all of the sons were put off to death, because the danger would have someone from his line eventually claiming the right to the kingdom and inciting a rebellion. So it would be a normal thing for anyone that was related to Saul for David to have put to death. Now, this is what you've got a picture here. There, in a sense, in Mephibosheth, is a death sentence as far as he is concerned. The only thing he can imagine that David is calling him for is he's trying to clean up house. And so Mephibosheth is on his way to die. He's going to fall before David, and if perchance there's mercy, fine. If not, he knows his time is up. And that's all he can think of. Now, I can't help but relate this particular chapter in a way typologically. Here is the king searching out for someone to show mercy to them on behalf of a covenant that he made with Jonathan, his father. So here's David looking for someone because he made a covenant with Jonathan to take care of his relatives. And David loved Jonathan. There was an incredible bond. And so that's where his thinking is. I want to show kindness. Is there anyone I can show kindness to? So Ziba gives him the word that Mephibosheth is around. Mephibosheth's coming, but he doesn't really know what's going to happen other than the fact that the enemy of his grandfather is calling him to court. And picture what it's like, in a way, from a type. Here we are in enmity with God. And we have the death sentence upon us because of sin. And there is that awesome fear of God, afraid of what he might do to us if he got a hold of us, what he might turn us into, if we gave our heart to him. And we're just terrified. Oh, we're fighting. We'll try anything but to come to God and relinquish our will and to trust him. And okay, God, and it's a difficult decision to make. To say, yes, Lord, here's my life. I want to give my life to you. I believe, that you truly love me. Because deep down inside, we have that fear. What will he do to us? He is God. He is all powerful. And we're afraid. And I picture Mephibosheth in that same way. He falls prostrate before David. And David then said to him, "Do not fear, for I will surely show you kindness for Jonathan, your father's sake, and will restore to you all the land of Saul, your grandfather, and you shall eat bread at my table continually." I mean, this is grace beyond grace being given to this guy. Not only is he a relative of Saul, which is a strike against him, but he's also lame, which in those days people thought you were cursed of God if something like that happened to you. God cursed you. So all his life he's grown up thinking God has cursed him, God hates him, God doesn't want anything for him, and now he's heard the king David going to call him, and well, this is it, my number's up. And all of a sudden he hears these words. Now to me, I can relate 100% with this. My biggest fear, when my first term in college, I was running from God. I was fighting God. I was doing everything possible to keep myself from running into Christians, if at all possible, and to stay away from any thoughts of God. I'd try anything, any philosophy. But the Lord had ways. He put people in my path to bring to my attention my need of him. And I remember when I finally, reluctantly, mind you, said, "Okay, God, I'll give you my life. I haven't been doing too good of it myself, so I'm going to give it to you." I had no idea. In my own understanding, I thought, well, what is he going to, it's going to be a boring life. I'll just resign to that, I guess. Christians live boring lives, so I'm willing for that. I can live with that. I haven't done too well on my own, so I'll be willing to be bored. That's okay. And I'm thinking to myself all the bad things, but I reluctantly give in. Okay, God, I'll give my life to you. And then to hear the pronouncement of David, it's similar. To see what the Lord has done, the joy, the peace, the grace that he abundantly bestows, the forgiveness, it's beyond comprehension. And here Mephibosheth feels this, and he bows and said, "What is your servant that you should look upon such a dead dog as I?" And the king called to Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, "I've given to your master's son all that belonged to Saul and all his house. You therefore and your sons and your servants shall work the land for him, and you shall bring in the harvest, and your master's son may have food to eat. But Mephibosheth, your master's son, shall eat bread at my table always." Now Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. And Ziba then said to the king, "According to all that my lord the king has commanded his servants, so will your servant do. And as for Mephibosheth, said the king, he shall eat at my table like one of the sons. So Mephibosheth had a young son whose name was Micah, and all who dwelt in the house of Ziba were servants of Mephibosheth. So Mephibosheth dwelt in Jerusalem, for he ate continually at the king's table, and he was lame in both feet. Now later, Ziba comes into play when David runs from his son Absalom, has to flee Jerusalem, crossing over the river, gets to the other side, and Ziba comes after him with a bunch of supplies. And Ziba tells a lie. It really doesn't say in the Bible. I mean, it doesn't tell you who's really telling the truth, whether Mephibosheth or Ziba. But you surmise that Ziba's telling a lie. That Mephibosheth, he tells David that Mephibosheth said that when you left, now the kingdom would be returned to him. And so David, hearing this, said, okay, Ziba, then everything I promised to him, I'm giving to you now. And I think that's what Ziba wanted. He was looking at all the resources, all the land, for his own power and his own prestige. Because later when David gets back to Jerusalem, there's Mephibosheth, having neither shaved nor done anything to take care of himself, but was in mourning all that time during David's absence. And David said, why didn't you go? And Mephibosheth says, well, it's because my servant Ziba took off and he told those lies about me. But David, I'm not that way. I didn't want the kingdom. It's enough for me to see you back. And you could see David's kind of like a little divided. He doesn't know who to believe. But he says, well, how about you and Ziba share the land? I didn't like that. I don't like that, what David said there. Share the land. It didn't set well with me. Because it just doesn't sound like he believed Mephibosheth. But you know, Mephibosheth honorably says, no, rather let him have all the land. I'm just glad you're back. So Mephibosheth was a cool guy, you know, in the end, I believe. Chapter 10. It happened after this that get by this verse here. I got through all those names fairly well. I can't get this simple verse. And it happened after this that the king of the people of Ammon died, and Hanun his son reigned in his place. And David said, I'll show kindness to Hanun the son of Nahash as his father showed kindness to me. It's possible that when he fled to Moab and he was there for a time, or his family was there, and then he also had some connection there with the people of Ammon, even though they had wars with him, there was still a respect. So David said, I'll show kindness to him as his father showed kindness to me. So David sent by the hand of his servants to comfort him concerning his father. And David's servants came to the land of the people of Ammon, and the princes of the people of Ammon said to Hanun their lord, do you think that David really honors your father because he has sent comforters to you? Has David not rather sent his servants to you to search the city, to spy it out, and to overthrow it? The wicked are suspicious often. They will scrutinize your motives. They will wonder what you really are up to. What's your ulterior motive? Why are you telling me this about Jesus? Why? What are you getting out of this by being a Christian and trying to get me to come to church? You know, do they give you a bonus for bringing people to church or what? You know, I mean, they're always suspicious. There's some ulterior motive there, you know. And the reason is because that's what they would do. They can't have it in their hearts to do something just magnanimous. They can't have that. It just doesn't exist. There's got to be something there. You know, you've heard people say that everybody has a price. You know, just what's your price? Like the girl that's asked by the guy, will you go to bed with me if I give you $1 million? And she's like, $1 million? Thinks about that, $1 million. $1 million. And she finally says, yeah. And he goes, will you go to bed with me for $10? She says, what kind of a girl do you think I am? He goes, we've already established that. We're just quibbling over price. You see, the world would think that everybody has a price. Do they? I think the wicked have a price. But how can you put a price on righteousness? How can you put a price on a relationship? When God has really touched your heart, you cannot compare that, the grace of the Lord, with all the world. What will it profit you if you gain the whole world but lose your own soul? But the wicked are suspicious. You know, what's David up to? You watch him. You know, he's just talking kindness here, but he's got something up his sleeve. What's he up to? And so they're suspicious. And so the son listens to his counselors, unfortunately. And therefore Hanun took David's servants, shaved off half their beards, cut off their garments in the middle at their buttocks, and sent them away. Well, this was a very big shame, not just because of coming back half naked, but the beard situation was the real issue. In those days, your beard, your length of beard, was your character, was your nature. If you're a beardless boy, you know that you're just a young little whippersnapper. You know, as you get older, you get your beard grows, it comes in full. You know, you're respected, and when it starts turning gray, you even get more respect. Well, here are these guys, he cuts half their beards off, and when David was told David, he sent to meet them because the men were greatly ashamed. The king said, "Wait at Jericho until your beards have grown, and then return." In other words, they couldn't even return home. It was such a shame. So he set them up in a place in Jericho for them to wait till their beards have grown back. I've heard this used as an illustration, and it is kind of interesting that reputation is like that. Now, if your reputation is soiled, it takes time to come back, a long time, just the same length of time it would take for a long beard to come back in. And after a while, people see you and they begin to see that you're trustworthy again and they'll trust you. But once you've soiled your reputation, it takes a long time for people to trust you again. And so it's a wise thing sometimes to wait aside until your beards have grown before you expect others to trust you. And here, these guys had to wait till Jericho. I think it's wise to be slow to believe the worst of people. As Hanan has a choice here, to listen to his counselors or to listen to the servants of David, he listens to the wrong people. The friends you get around are very important. The people, the counsel that you get. Don't underestimate that. You know, I did not have good, solid counsel when I was a young man, and I made a lot of foolish decisions as a result of it. But when you have people that can give you solid counsel, that's why it makes so much sense to get around godly people. Get plugged into a home group. Start making close friends of people who are godly and desiring to serve the Lord. And then when you're in trouble or situations are happening in your life that you need answers, you've got good godly counsel around you. You don't have foolish people telling you, "Well, if I were you, I would do this," and you do some dumb thing. And that's what this guy does. And because of that, it costs him a foolish decision to make an enemy of David. You know, but he's thinking his tough. You know, he's listening to the counsel that appeals to his pride. We'll teach him. He was very quick to believe the worst of people. You've met people like that. You know, that they're just quick to believe the worst. Why do you think bad news travels so much quicker than good news? Because most people are quick to believe the worst of people. You know, I've learned that it's wise to give people the benefit of the doubt. To make no judgment call. Be very, very slow to make that judgment call in a situation until you've heard both sides, until you've seen the whole picture. I'm very reticent to make a quick judgment and a rash judgment because oftentimes when hearing just one side, you're wrong. You know, and believe me, in marriage situations, I've heard it all. You'll hear one person say, you know, something and you'll think, man, that husband, he is 100% USDA prime beef jerky. And, you know, then you'll talk with him and you'll realize, well, there's another side to this, you know. That wasn't exactly, you know, the spin on it wasn't exactly right. And it's true. I mean, we put the spin on things when we talk to people. We choose our words carefully. And we're very careful to put ourselves in the best light. So it's important to not learn or to not believe the worst in people. Give people the benefit of the doubt. As it cost to Hanan. So when the people of Ammon saw that they had made themselves repulsive to David, in other words, they knew what they were doing. They really pushed his buttons. People of Ammon sent and hired the Syrians of Beth-Rabab, of the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and from King Machas, 1,000 men, and from Ishdab, 12,000 men. And when David heard of it, he sent Joab and the army of the mighty men. And the people of Ammon came out and put themselves in battle array at the entrance of the gate, and the Syrians of Zobah, Rebab and Ishtab, and Mechah were there by themselves in the field. And when Joab saw the battle line was against him, both before and behind, he was kind of bottled in, he chose some of the choice men of Israel and put them in battle array against the Syrians. And the rest of the people he put under the command of Abishai, his brother, that he might put them in battle array against the people of Ammon. In other words, he's sending Abishai to go up against the city, the fortress there with the people, and the other nations or the countries that are coming from the other direction Joab takes. And he says, "If the Syrians are too strong for you, then you shall help me. But if the people of Ammon are too strong for you, then I'll come and help you." What a great brotherly picture here. I tell you, this to me, it's got men's retreat written all over it, guys. This has got a men's ministry here. You know, it's like we're helping each other. There's going to be times when you're up against something that's too tough for you, and you're going to need to rely on somebody else. And there's other times when your brothers are going to need some help in doing the battles of the Lord and fighting his battles and doing the right thing. It's going to be difficult. And you see the two of them are there hand in hand, and there's this mutual encouragement. And as it works out, neither of them need each other, which is great. Because they have the security there that they're going to be receiving help. And so he says, be of good courage and let us be strong for our people and for the cities of our God, and may the Lord do what seems good to him. And Joab and the people who were with him drew near for the battle against the Syrians, and they fled before them. And when the people of Ammon saw the Syrians were fleeing, they also fled. That kind of creates a chain reaction, you know. If the people you hired to come and fight are running, you're not going to hang around and get beaten up, so you're going to run too. I remember a wild situation that happened in high school. I went away to a wrestling camp, and we were probably about 250, 300 strong at this camp from the ages of probably, well, it was a high school camp, so 15 through 18, something like that, 14 through 18. And we're at this city, probably, it's a little city, a little town in the middle of nowhere, a small town of maybe 15,000 people, and we basically take over the town. You know, we're coming in and we're working out during the day, but at night we're hitting the different restaurants and the different places. And some of the people who are older went into a lot of the bars and began, you know, pushing their weight around and picking up on the women. And consequently, we made ourselves odious in the sight of the people of the town. Well, one afternoon, we're out there doing our calisthenics in the field, all 250 strong of us. And around the corner comes this line of cars with guys just falling out of all these cars and these trucks. They've got clubs and chains and knives, and they're coming around slowly, and they park, and we're watching this, and they get out of their trucks and they start walking toward us, probably about 50 guys. And first we saw this, it was my initial reaction is, these guys are nuts. These are wrestlers. It doesn't matter whether we're younger, we're going to take them, you know. And so I'm thinking, this is incredible. This is before I was a Christian, mind you. But all these guys were coming, and what happened, it was wild. We're standing our ground, and I'm watching, this is going to be interesting to see what's going to happen. And I figured some of the older guys who were in the bars that were making trouble would be the ones that would take the lead in this and fight for our interests, our pride as wrestlers. And so we're walking toward these guys. And the next thing you know, I turn around and half the wrestlers are running. And when I saw them running, it kind of like, you know, kind of, I was looking and I was like, I'm not going to stick around. I started running. All of us were running. None of us stuck around. But it happens. It's a chain reaction. Silly illustration. Sorry I did that to you. But verse 15. When the Syrians saw that they had been defeated before Israel, they had gathered together and Hadadezer sent and brought out the Syrians who were beyond the river. And they came to Helam, and Shobath, the commander of Hadadezer's army, went before them. And it was told David, he gathered all Israel, crossed over the Jordan, and came to Helam. And the Syrians set themselves in the battle array against David and fought with him. And the Syrians fled before Israel, and David killed 700 charioteers and 40,000 horsemen of the Syrians, and struck Shobath, the commander of their army, who died there. And when all the kings who were servants to Hadadezer saw that they were defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them. So the Syrians were afraid to help the people of Ammon anymore. So in other words, the enemies are being confounded. They're trying to league together to go against David. In the same way, in the end times, the nations are going to league together and try to go and fight under the authority of the Antichrist. They're going to try to fight God, if you can imagine. They're going to try to fight God. Well, it's a losing battle. In the same way, they come to the final conclusion that we're not going to defeat him. And eventually, they don't help each other out. It kind of reminds me in a way of what's happening currently in Israel with the Six-Day War and the Yom Kippur War and the nations, the coalition of nations against Israel. Well, in the first time when they attacked Israel, they lost, and they lost a lot of ground. And so you notice that Jordan was very hesitant the next time to step into the fray. Egypt eventually did not want to get into the fray. And you find that eventually it just is Syria and Iran and some of those types of coalitions. But Jordan and Egypt, they basically got fairly good relationships with. Because, you know, Jordan and Egypt both learned what they lost in fighting against Israel. It didn't pay. And I think there's an interesting parallel there. But now we come to chapters 11 and 12, and that's where I want to really spend a little time. It came to pass in the spring of the year, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him, delegating to them and all Israel, and they destroyed the people of Ammon and besieged Rabbah, but David remained at Jerusalem. Now notice that little phrase there tells us everything we need to know of what's about to take place. There is something ominous in this. It's always something ominous when you leave off that which you should be doing. You know, there are sins of commission and there are sins of omission. There are sins that are sins because of something we have done, but there are also sins of things that we're not doing that we should have done. And it's not wise to leave undone that which we should do. And in fact, when you look at the law of God, you know, people focus on the negative, and then naturally the commandments, in a sense, are negative. Thou shalt not, thou shalt not. But when you understand the spirit of the law of God, everything is fulfilled, as Jesus said, in one law, or two laws, actually, loving God with all your heart and loving neighbor as yourself. Now, if you focus on the negative, that which you shouldn't do, then you're missing a predominant amount of what Christianity is all about. That's why we don't live by the letter of the law. But the spirit of the law is so much more rich. Even in the philosophers of the time before Jesus, Plato and Aristotle came to some very strong moral maxims about life, and even to the point where I think it might have been Socrates who said, "Do not do to others what you would not want them to do to you." Now that sounds very similar to the Golden Rule, but there's a very big difference between that and what Jesus said, "Do unto others what you would have them do unto you." The one is basically from a negative, you know, what you don't want to do against them, negative. So people walk around with that in mind, thinking themselves fairly good people because of what they don't do to others. I'm a pretty good citizen. I'm a pretty good husband. I'm a pretty good father. I'm a pretty good this. I'm a pretty good that because of what I don't do. Well, from God's perspective, you're missing the mark. Because he says, do unto others what you would have them do to you. Now, let your imagination think about that for a second. Stretch your mind and imagine what that entails. Doing unto others. Think about what you'd like someone to do for you. Let your imagination run wild. What kind of a friend would you like to have? What kind of people around you would you like? What would you like your friends to do for you and people to, you know, how would you want them to treat you? Now actively put that into practice in your relationships with others. Right now, put that into practice. Start living a life that you're an exemplary friend, an exemplary husband, exemplary wife, an exemplary person, an employee, doing, you know, for others what you would want them to do for you. That's the Golden Rule. That is beyond what we have the capacity to do. But it's the sin, we look at the sins of commission as the bad things. Well, I don't want to do that, and I don't want to do that because those are bad. But it's the problem that you and I run into are the things we leave undone. I think that's the trouble. And here, David, there is the greater thing here. He's not where he should be. He's the head of the army. He should be out there. But he remained at Jerusalem. And then it happened one evening that David arose from his bed, walked on the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful to behold. So David sent and inquired about the woman, and someone said, that was his first, you know, first it was where he was. The second thing, he's curious. Oh, who is that woman? And, you know, when you start asking questions, you shouldn't even ask. You start entertaining thoughts that you shouldn't even entertain. His eyes have wandered. Now he has seen. And now he's curious. And so he asks, who is that woman? And he finds out it's Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Now whether or not he thought, oh, Uriah's not home. He's out in the battlefield. She's all alone. And the thought of her being alone just went around in his mind, thinking about her there, bathing down there, and all alone. And, you know, as he began thinking and pondering it, you know how sin works. Well, he calls for her, sent messengers. Now he takes the action. See, it was already conceived in his thoughts. And now it's bringing forth its fruit. He calls for her. And she came to him, and he lay with her, for she was cleansed from her impurity. Now, it doesn't indict her at all. It does not say whether she had the power to resist him, whether she could have refused. I think she could have. She could have at least put her resistance up and says, no, don't do so wickedly, my Lord. How could I do this? How could I commit this shameful act? And she could have. But I think that there was some guilt on her part. But the woman conceived. One note on this, she was cleansed from her impurity. That simply means that, over the time of her flow of blood, it was complete, and the days passed from which she would have been impure from that flow of blood have been completed. So in a way, this is kind of a way, if you understand the physiology of a woman, she's very fertile at this point. She's very fertile. She is ready, she'd be ready to conceive if someone had relationships with her. So she does conceive, and she told David and says, I'm with child. Now, David's sent to Joab. Now, he hears this word, and I would imagine, he's thinking after he got away with this, oh, no one's going to know. It's cool. And then he gets word. She's pregnant. Now his mind begins working even more wickedly. And it's true. Every sin has children. You can't get away from it. Every little sin has children. It'll always lead to something else. It's just the nature of sin. So David sent to Joab and saying, send me Uriah the Hittite. So Joab sent to Uriah to David. And when Uriah had come to him, David asked how Joab was doing and how the people were doing and how the war prospered. You liar. I just pictured David deceiving him, really like showing concern. How's everything going? You're one of my good men, David said then to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. So Uriah departed from the king's house, and a gift from food followed him. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and did not go down to his house. So when they told David, saying, Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, didn't you come from a journey? Why did you not go down to your house? Now, David, of course, it's obvious what he's trying to do. He's trying to get his, her husband to sleep with her so that the child that comes or that is there will be, he'll think it's his. I'm sure if he calculated the time, he'd figure something's wrong, but pretty much it would be at least something he'd have an excuse for. Well, Uriah didn't go down, and he answers David, the ark and Israel and Judah are dwelling in tents. And my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are encamped in the open fields. Shall I then go to my house to eat and drink and to lie with my wife? As you live and your soul lives, I will not do this thing. David at one point in his life was noble like this. When the men risked their lives to bring him water from the well of Jerusalem and Bethlehem, and he poured it out before them and says, I will not drink the blood of these men. And the people endeared themselves to him. That was a noble act. He was concerned about his men. He was concerned about others. And here is Uriah following his hero, David's example. David's still a hero. He's noble. He's done everything good for the kingdom. Not one failure, one fault that people can find in him. And Uriah's sitting there, man, I'm talking to the king. It's so cool. He is so cool. He's my hero. And he almost maybe thinks this is a test for his nobility. And he's thinking, David's giving me a test right now. He wants to see if I'll be selfish and go sleep with my wife. I'm not going to do it. I can just picture him. And he's noble. Well, then David said to Uriah, well, wait here today and also tomorrow I'll let you depart. So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. And when David called him, he ate and drank before him, and he made him drunk. And at evening he went out to lie in his bed with the servants of his Lord, but he did not go down to his house. So now David's trying to get him drunk. Maybe he'll go then, maybe when reason departs from him. What's interesting here? That Pilate was in a similar dilemma. David is concerned now about his reputation more than anything. If this word gets out, his reputation's shot. So he's playing the cover-up. He's worried about what people are going to think of him in this sin. And he's doing everything he can. Now, he doesn't want to hurt Uriah. He doesn't want to do anything against the guy. He's trying to give Uriah any other chance he can. Come on, Uriah, go down and be with your wife. Now, remember Pilate, who in the scriptures, it seemed very much that he wanted to let Jesus go. He saw no wickedness in him. And even his wife warned him, don't have anything to do with this man. And so Pilate was determined to let Jesus go. But as he made moves in that direction, it wasn't working out too well. Because the people were getting very upset. The Pharisees had stirred the people up for Jesus to be crucified. And Pilate is in this dilemma. Shall he do the right thing, even though it will cost him his political career? Or will he bow down to his reputation, his political career, what he wants from people, fear of man, to do something wrong? That's what David is doing right here. Same thing. He's sacrificing this man Uriah because in the morning it was so that David wrote a letter to Joab, sent it by the hand of Uriah, and he wrote in the letter saying, set Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle and retreat from him that he may be struck down and die. So it happened while Joab besieged the city that he assigned Uriah to a place where he knew there were valiant men. And the men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the people of the servants of David fell, and Uriah the Hittite died also. Joab doesn't ask any questions. I mean, there could have been a lot of complicity here between David and Joab. Joab might be thinking, he wants me to get rid of this guy. I wonder why. I'm sure Joab sought it out, found out why. And I'm sure Joab probably used that against David and also for his own political career. You know, it was kind of like something he held over David. Because Joab did a lot of bad things and got away with it. Well, Joab sent and told David all the things concerning the war and charged the messenger, saying, when you have finished telling the matters of the war to the king, it happens when the king that the king's wrath rises. If he says to you, why did you approach so near the city when you fought? Did you not know that they would shoot from the wall? Who struck Abimelech, the son of was it not a woman who cast a piece of millstone on him from the wall so that he died in Thebes? Why did you go near the wall? Then you shall say to your servant, Uriah the Hittite is dead also. And so the messenger went and came and told David all that Joab had sent by him. And the messenger said to David, surely the men prevailed against us and came out into the field, and we drove them back as far as the entrance of the gate. And the archers shot from the wall at your servants, and some of the servants, king's servants, are dead, and your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. So David said to the messenger, thus you shall say to Joab, do not let this thing displease you, for the sword devours one as well as the other. Strengthen your attack against the city and overthrow it, so encourage him. David hears the word. Uriah is out of the way. No one will know. When the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. Whether it was just a true mourning or whether or not just she was playing the part, we don't know. One thing about Bathsheba later on, you'll find she was a very noble woman in many respects, had a lot of great qualities. Wise, gave Solomon good counsel. But at the same time, you know, this happened. When her mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. This is what matters. This is really, really what matters, because the Lord sees the heart. What we do, what we are in front of people, we can be a certain way, and people may never know. But God knows. He sees the secret things of the heart, and that's where we need to stand before him, open and naked before him. He's the one with whom we'll have our dealings with. He's the one at the end of our life where we want to hear, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Then everything will, you know, that'll make everything worth it. That's what counts. But you know, it's a sad, sad thing to see our hero go down like this. Now, my question comes in often, my own heart. Why, Lord, did you allow this to happen to David? You could have prevented this. You could have hedged his way. You could have closed the opportunity. You see, if the Lord does that for us all the time, then we'll never know what we're capable of. We'll have an inflated picture of ourselves, won't we? we'll think ourselves a lot more strong than we really, really are. But what we really need to learn, and I think the lesson here, is that we're all weak. We all have the potential to do this. I mean, this is nothing compared with what we have the potential to do. Knowing that, then, we'll not think too highly of ourselves and we'll be apt to turn to Him in a good, godly fear. Lord, help me. I'm unable to handle this temptation. It's when we're strong we have to look out. When we're weak, we depend upon the Lord. But when we're strong, sometimes we think ourselves more highly than we ought to. Well, God allowed it, but it displeased the Lord. The Lord sent to Nathan to David, and he came to him and said to him, there were two men in one city. Now, picture Nathan coming to David. He's a young prophet, but he's got to boldly speak the truth. David's the king, powerful. So he's coming with a message, but how he appeals to David is wise. He doesn't come in with all this pomp and just start accusing him of what he did. He wants to bring David's conscience to bear on this. So he came to him and said to him, this little parable. One thing about this parable, when Jesus talked in parables, it was for a couple of reasons. One, it was to let those who were of the heart and of the kingdom mindset to have more of an insight into the biblical truth. But it also had another meaning. Jesus spoke in parables to not just reveal, as in the sense of a story opens more illustrations into a truth, but he also teaches in parables. He also taught in parables to hide from the proud the things that he was speaking. You know, it's the glory of God to conceal a matter. It's the glory of kings to search out a matter. And a parable was done in such a way, Jesus artfully taught, that those to whom that really were wicked and had no intention of following God just didn't get it. And those who did got the point. So the parable is very telling. There were two men in one city, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had exceedingly many flocks and herds. The poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he had bought and nourished, and it grew up together with him and with his children, and ate of his own food and drank from his own cup and lay with his own in his own bosom. It was like a daughter to him. And a traveler came to the rich man, who refused to take of his own flock and from his own herd to prepare one for the wayfaring man who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared it for the man who had come to him. David's anger was greatly aroused against the man, and he said to Nathan, as the Lord lives, the man who has done this shall surely die. And he shall restore fourfold because of the lamb, because he did this thing and because he had no pity. Now this is a lesson in itself. How we look at others and judge others, we don't live by the same standard. You know, David is ready to just let this guy be put to death for the sake of a lamb. And yet David has done much worse than that. Do we ever do that? Do we do something wrong and then if someone else does it, you know, we get offended? How dare they? You know, we don't see ourselves, do we? It's a problem we have. God has to teach us. And God is teaching David here. Because when he says this, Nathan says to David, you are the man. Whoa, that must have hit him like a knife through butter. It just must have pierced him. I'm the man. The Lord, thus says the Lord God of Israel, I anointed you king over Israel. I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house and your master's wives into your keeping and gave you the house of Israel and Judah. And if that had been too little, I would have given you much more. Mark those words, I would have given you much more. When we're in that position, and the Lord has provided for us, and we're discontent, and we sin as a result of our discontentment. The arrows of discontentment hit us, and we want, we lust, we covet, we need, and we crave, and we take matters into our own hands, and we go after that sin. The Lord's judgment is right there. He says, I would have given you much more. But he says, why have you despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil in his sight? You have killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword. You have taken his wife to be your wife, and have killed him with the sword of the people of Ammon. Now therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, because you have despised me, and have taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your wife. Thus says the Lord, behold, I will raise up adversity against you from your own house, and I will take your wives before your eyes and give them to your neighbor, and he will lie with your wives in the sight of the sun. For you did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel, before the sun. And David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said to David, the Lord has also put away your sin. You shall not die. I'm not going to give you the judgment that you pronounced. However, because by this deed you have given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also who was born to you shall surely die. When we commit a sin, we do give the enemies of God a chance to blaspheme, especially when something becomes notable. It becomes a scourge. People look at that and they go, all Christians are like that. You know, there must not be really a God. They begin blaspheming God for allowing this. I'm communicating with a few people on the internet that have a lot of bitterness against God because of what he allows. These charlatans and these false teachers that go on ripping people off, live in these million-dollar homes and beg for, you know, a dollar here and a dollar there from widows on Social Security. And some of these men are absolutely livid against these men, wondering, why doesn't God strike them dead? Why does he let them get away with it? It causes people an opportunity to blaspheme God when a person sins. But notice, the Lord forgives him. You won't die. The Lord has put away your sin. You can be forgiven. What an incredible thing that we have with the Lord. And yet, understand that there are still consequences to his sin. It gets real complicated, but we see the first part of his judgment. The child shall also die in the rest of this chapter. But we also see the following chapters, everything unfold before David. And it kind of starts with one of his sons committing incest with one of his daughters, rapes her. She's ashamed. And then he, after he rapes her, he doesn't even want her. And they were half-sister, half-brother. And then the brother of this girl who was raped, you know, he goes out and he plans to kill Amnon, who did this. And so eventually David's got rape in his family. He's got murder in his family. And he's got all kinds of turmoil. But one of the most interesting things is that Bathsheba, her grandfather, is Ahithophel, who was David's counselor, a wise counselor. And he finds out about this somehow, but you find later Ahithophel rebels against David. He holds this bitterness in his heart and eventually almost is the cause of David's death. It becomes very, very touch and go. What's it worth? You know, I mean, think about this. Think of the cost that David paid for this stupid sin. I mean, it cost him so much. And yet when you look at how God worked everything out, it's amazing. Even when it comes down to Bathsheba being his wife and bearing Solomon, designed from the foundation of the world to reign, God chose him. He was the man that God raised up, this son of Bathsheba, but he would have never been had David not sinned. Isn't that amazing? How God can work things out. Yes, we've spoiled our life. We've messed it up. Things have just gone bad. We've done the wrong thing. We've done things that are irreplaceable. We can't change. And yet know that God is merciful and can even turn it around and put it into his perfect plan. Weave it right there if we'll but come to him. But in the meantime, we've suffered a lot for our sin, haven't we? It's hurt. It's caused a lot of pain. It's not what God would have had in mind for us. Well, Nathan departed to his house, and the Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife bore to David and became very ill. And David therefore pleaded with God for the child. And David fasted, went in, lay all night in the ground. The elders of his house arose and went to him to raise him up from the ground, but he would not, nor would he eat food with them. And on the seventh day it came to pass, the child died. And the servants of David were afraid to tell him that the child was dead, for they said, indeed, while the child was still alive when we spoke to him, he wouldn't heed our voice. How can we tell him the child is dead? He may do some harm. When David saw his servants were whispering, David perceived the child was dead, and therefore David said to his servants, is the child dead? And they said, he's dead. And David arose from the ground, washed and anointed himself, changed his clothes, and went into the house of the Lord and worshipped. And he went to his own house. And when he requested, they sent food before him, and he ate. And the servant said to him, what is this you have done? You fasted and wept for the child while he was alive, but when the child died, you arose and ate food. So he said, while the child was still alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, who can tell whether the Lord will be gracious to me that the child may live? But now he is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he shall not return to me. And David comforted Bathsheba, his wife. Just as an aside on that, you know, we have a lot of mourning and a funeral when someone goes. But the biggest thing I feel people deal with in the loss of a loved one is, again, those undone and unsaid things that they wish they had done and had said before that person was gone. You know, life's regrets. David, I think, has a good handle on it. He's doing what he can do while the child is alive. Once the child's dead, why mourn any longer? God made a choice. He took the child. But I believe there's a lesson in here for us to really think in terms of what we can do while people are alive, not wait till they're gone. Well, David comforted Bathsheba and his wife and went into her and lay with her. So she bore him a son. He called the name Solomon, and the Lord loved him. And he sent word by the hand of Nathan the prophet, so he called his name Jedidiah because of the Lord. So the name of Jedidiah is beloved of the Lord. The Lord loved him, and the Lord has a purpose for him, and we'll see that. Now Joab fought against Rabbah, the people of Ammon, and took the royal city. And Joab sent messengers to David and said, I fought against Rabbah, and I've taken the city's water supply. Now therefore gather the rest of the people together and encamp against the city and take it, lest I take the city and it be called by my name. So David gathered all the people together and went to Rabbah, fought against it, and took it. And he took their king's crown from his head. Its weight was a talent of gold with precious stones. And it was set on David's head, so he brought out the spoil of the city in great abundance. And he brought out the people who were in it, put them to work with saws and iron picks and iron axes, and made them cross over to the brickworks. So he did with all the cities of the people of Ammon. And then David and all the people returned to Jerusalem. So it closes up that whole story of when he should have been there at the battle. He wasn't. But at the very end of the battle, he gets credit for the battle. So go figure. Against it and took it. And he took their king's crown from his head. Its weight was a talent of gold with precious stones. And it was set on David's head. So he brought out the spoil of the city in great abundance. And he brought out the people who were in it, put them to work with saws and iron picks and iron axes, and made them cross over to the brickworks. So he did with all the cities of the people of Ammon. And then David and all the people returned to Jerusalem. So it closes up that whole story of when he should have been there at the battle. He wasn't. But at the very end of the battle, he gets credit for the battle. So go figure. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for your word. Lord, I thank you as these words just are a searchlight into our own hearts, a lamp to our soul, revealing the thoughts and intentions of our own hearts. Lord, we know that we are weak and frail, very vulnerable. And how we look to you for your mercies to help us, to set our feet on a solid spot, to remember where we came from and what you have done in our life, and to simply walk with you humbly and trusting that you'll grant to us whatever we need, and if that's not enough, you'll even grant more. You're faithful. You're good. Help us to trust you, Lord. Help us to not go after our own methods and schemes and sins, because we know that's only going to hurt us in the end. But you love us, Lord. You don't want us to have to learn the hard way. You've given us this word that we might learn these lessons and trust you without having to learn the hard way. Thank you, Lord. We rejoice in you. Maybe there are some here tonight